Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. What happens when political appointees take over from the expert, from Ukraine to the Veterans Administration? I speak with President Trump's former VA Secretary, David Shulkin. Then, from the Far East to the Middle East to Latin America, citizens take to the streets to voice discontent. Former Colombian President Santos joins us with solutions. And
Trump Dumpty wanted a wall to stir up a rabid political brawl.
Actor John Lithgow goes unapologetically and poetically political. He speaks with our Hari Srinivasan about his book, Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. What's it like for a policy expert to serve in the current U.S. administration? That question is front and center today as the National Security Council's top Ukraine expert, Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, testifies behind closed doors to House investigators. Vindman personally listened in on President Trump's July phone call with Ukraine's leader and told investigators that he was immediately concerned. Quote, I did not think it was proper to demand that a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen. Following the call, I again reported my concerns to NSC's lead counsel. David Shulkin is intimately familiar with what happens when policy plays second fiddle to politics. The former Secretary of Veterans Affairs is the first former Trump cabinet member to speak completely openly about his experience. His new book is called It Shouldn't Be This Hard to Serve Your Country, Our Broken Government and the Plight of Veterans. And he's joining me now from Boston. Secretary Shulkin, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me just first start by asking you the connection, your connection with what we're seeing on Capitol Hill today. And that is yet another expert who was on the NSC talking about what happens when political appointees and others take over from expertise. When you see what Vindman, according to his opening statement anyway, is saying, how does that resonate with you today?
Well, the story that I share in my book about what happened to me is extremely similar to what I'm seeing happen again. It's a repeat pattern of behavior where dedicated career employees, people really trying to serve their government as public servants, are being interfered with and seeing things that frankly shouldn't happen. And I'm so glad that there are so many people willing to speak up and talk about what's right.
Well, why do you think that's happening now? I mean, you've obviously had a good deal of time to reflect, to write, and now you're speaking about it. Just before we get into the nitty-gritty of what happened to you, why do you think more and more people are coming out now whose jobs are on the line and at stake by coming out? They're currently serving.
I think people are seeing a real risk to our democracy and seeing the trust being eroded within government and feeling a real duty. People who serve in government often have other choices. I came from the private sector myself, but our belief is that citizens need to do the right thing to make this government work, and speaking out when they see something wrong, it's an American value.
So, Secretary Shulkin, let me ask you about what happened to you. In your book and in op-eds and the like, you have written about a toxic and chaotic and subversive situation when it comes to outside appointees or inside appointees doing end runs around policy appointees such as yourself. What happened to you who, after all, you were specifically chosen by President Trump, even though you started as VA secretary or in the VA under President Obama?
Yeah, I was one of the very few, the only one in the cabinet who had worked for President Obama, and I was confirmed 100-0. And I had hoped that we would continue to keep veterans' issues and doing better for our country's veterans apolitical and outside of all the gamesmanship that I was watching happening in Washington. But unfortunately, that just wasn't the case. And a few political appointees in the organization, in the Department of Veteran Affairs, thought that the Department of Veteran Affairs should be moving in a different direction towards privatization. And I just wasn't willing to go along with that. I didn't think that was the right thing for veterans or what veterans wanted. And so we had a clash. And ultimately, President Trump ended up changing his mind and said he wanted to go with a different direction for a different secretary.
So let's just go a little bit from the beginning. We're going to show now a little bit of tape of President Trump essentially talking about you. This was back in June 2017 when things were going well.
I also want to express our appreciation for Secretary Shulkin, who is implementing the dramatic reform throughout the VA. It's got to be implemented. If it's not properly implemented, it will never mean the same thing. But I have no doubt it will be properly implemented. Right, David? Better be David. We'll never have to use those words. We'll never have to use those words on our David.
Well, I mean, it really could not be more of a hearty endorsement from the president to you. You did have, just describe your working relationship. I mean, you did go to the White House, you had meetings. You had a pretty good working relationship.
Well, we were getting a lot done. And frankly, we were fixing a lot of the things in the VA that had been broken for decades. And so that very first year when I was secretary, we got 11 bills through Congress in a bipartisan way, and the president signed them. And frankly, I think the president enjoyed seeing all the progress that was happening. But as you're seeing, even today, there are so many people now bringing their opinions and their political ideologies into policymaking that, frankly, it gets derailed. And it's really important that the work of government stay focused on what's right for the people it's serving and not get into these political derailments.
So describe for us then, what was the political drama that surrounded you? I mean, there were political appointees. There were also friends of the president's, people who were your subordinates inside the VA, who, as I said, were doing end runs around you. How did that happen? What started to make your tenure there go off the rails?
Well, I think that, I wasn't some of the initial political appointees' original choice for secretary. I think their choice by the president of selecting me was somewhat of a surprise. And so I wasn't easily controlled. I was following a bipartisan path. I was following what I thought was right for the veterans, and that frustrated them to the point that they ended up doing essentially internal sabotage, leaking false information to take away from my ability to lead the organization, creating enough political turmoil that ultimately it did end up derailing my tenure as secretary and, frankly, stopping some of the progress that we were making. And the real issue that was the central issue was this issue of, do we continue to support a strong VA or do we move much more rapidly towards privatizing a system that, frankly, I think is part of our commitment that we've made when our men and women go off to defend us, that we're going to be there for them when they come back home.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you have that view, and you took that view to the president at a particular time, and he tended to side with you. You were speaking about the importance of what you've just told me, that it can't all suddenly be privatized, that, as you say, veterans deserve a huge amount, and it can't all happen overnight. And while you were having a meeting with the president, he called a friend and an advisor who happened to be a Fox News contributor. His name is Peter Hegseth, supporter of privatization, asked him to weigh in. And incredibly, Hegseth apparently said, according to what you say, I have the secretary here with me. He says, we can't do this all now because it would cost us over $50 billion. So, Pete, we have to take our time. So the president basically kind of pushing away those who might be on the privatization now bandwagon. I mean, that was a victory for you. How again did that start getting whittled away? What happened after that?
Yeah. When I had a chance to directly talk with the president and present my views and give him a full picture of why I was making the decisions that I made, I generally found his support. What was very hard to control was where he got his other information from. And I think we see this, that the president and many presidents will do this, reach out to people that they know, their advisors, and get information. The information that the president was getting from outside people, and the example that you just used of the Fox News reporter is an example of that, was often very different than the information that I was giving him as secretary. And ultimately, the president needs to decide which information he's going to rely upon and make his decisions based upon. And, I think that I had no control over where he was getting all this different information and the sources that he would choose to get it from.
Mm-hmm. It should be said that before being secretary of the VA, you were in private practice, right? I mean, you were a physician, you are. You had turned around many or several significant failing hospital institutions. And so you came to this with a huge amount of expertise. We've just described the support you had from the president and then how it was being whittled away. Let's just show just how you learned you were being cut out of the loop. This is another meeting in the White House about an upcoming meeting.
We're having a meeting tonight at what we call affectionately the Southern White House. Seems to be the most convenient location. Everybody always wants to go to the Southern White House. So are you going to be at that meeting? You heard about it, right? It's going to be great. All about the VA.
Yowza, what was going on in your head there? I mean, you said you shook your head no, and then you nodded your head yes. What was happening as he said that to you?
Well, I was confused, as probably everybody. That happened to be a nationally televised meeting where that happened. How could you have a meeting about veterans policy and the future of veterans care in this country and not have the secretary of the VA there? That began to allow me to see some insights into how the decision making was going on. And it was always somewhat of a surprise when you worked in the administration, not knowing exactly where the president was getting his information from. And, it was certainly a source of concern for me because I wanted the president to have the right information and the information that was coming from the secretary, who was a Senate-confirmed appointee in the cabinet to make sure that the president was getting the right information.
Mm-hmm. Secretary Shulkin, I just want to refer back. The president has basically poured cold water over Colonel Vindman, who's testifying today, saying he wasn't on the call. I don't even know who he is. And as you know, your critics will be coming at you because of the ethics lapse that you were, confronted with. And we have basically the Washington Post headline, VA chief took Wimbledon river cruise on European work trip. Wife expenses covered by taxpayers. Now, there was an investigation. You say a lot of this was distorted or false, but the internal report said that you did mislead agency ethics officials. Tell us about that and how you think that is going to be, used to damage your credibility now on this issue.
Well, I wrote the book to give the details of that, so I'm going to let the readers make up their mind. I was completely transparent in everything that happened, and I maintain that absolutely everything was done the way that it should be done. But, that's something about 2 years ago. I think what we're really seeing is that there's an effort underway to discredit people who speak out and are doing it as a sense of duty. And I knew when I wrote this book, and I knew when I would speak out, that there will be people coming after me, attacking my integrity and my ethics. But I feel that it's my duty as an American citizen, having had the chance to have had this view from the seat that I had, to speak out, because I believe public service is in real danger if we don't support the people that are trying to do the right thing, and that we need a reset in Washington to create an environment where we can all perform better and make this government work better for its citizens.
Mm-hmm. And Secretary Shulkin, you talk about, you know, sabotage, and it's almost like Keystone Cops. I mean, it's almost like a comedic if it wasn't so utterly serious. There's this famous copy machine incident where you actually found out that you were being actively sabotaged, undermined, plotted against by these appointees, political appointees, who, again, were your subordinates. They were working for you, not vice versa.
Right. You know, I'm a physician. I'm trained in science. And so while many people in my agency were telling me, watch your back, there are people in your agency working against you, I frankly didn't spend much time paying attention to that. I had too many important things working on behalf of veterans to worry about what I thought were games, until one day they happened to leave a memo detailing their exact plan to have me removed. They left it on a copy machine, and a staff member brought it to my deputy secretary, who brought it to me, where clearly outlined in writing, these political appointees were planning to have me removed, my deputy secretary removed, my chief of staff removed, my acting undersecretary removed, and replace them with people that they thought were more ideologically aligned with their views of where the VA should go. And so at that point, then, I just couldn't ignore it. And it was really that type of hard evidence.
And then you learned that you were actually fired by tweet. And that has happened quite a few times. Secretary David Shulkin, thank you very much indeed for joining us. As you say, it shouldn't be this hard to serve your country. Thank you indeed. Now, discontent isn't just for government insiders. It is rising from the street all around the world. Political protests in Hong Kong, pocketbook demonstrations from Lebanon to Chile. Citizens in rich and poor nations are voicing their dissatisfaction. And in Beirut this afternoon, Prime Minister Saad Hariri has become the first to fall on his sword, announcing his resignation after nearly 2 weeks of grassroots anger. The protests were first triggered by a proposed tax on WhatsApp calls. Today, there were some violent confrontations with Lebanese security forces, such as the one you're seeing here. An incredible 37% of Lebanese under the age of 35 are unemployed. And the UN says the poverty rate has risen by two-thirds since 2011. Now, Mona Fawaz is a professor at the American University of Beirut, and she's been heavily involved in organizing the protest and working on a set of goals. She joins me from Beirut, where demonstrations are still going on, and it's pretty loud there at this hour. Mona Fawaz, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let me just ask you from the beginning. We've seen the Prime Minister listen to what the street has said, and he has offered his resignation. But what does that mean? What happens next? There will be a caretaker government. The president is still in place. What happens next?
Right. Well, I think in order to understand the significance of today's resignation, and as you notice, I'm having a hard time hearing you, you have to hear the celebrations that are happening on the street and to really locate them in their context. What people are celebrating today is not necessarily the resignation as much as this the opportunity that the country has to set itself on a new course. A course that's different from the financial crisis, from the poverty, the environmental deterioration, and the cost that we've been living in the last 30 years. So there was a moment in which the protests that started, that were sparked really by an unjust tax, turned into a massive protest that went way beyond the usual size, but also way beyond the usual locations in which the protests were happening. And by Reuters' account, there were some 2 million people who were on the street across all the nation, and they were first really demanding more justice and a life in dignity. But then when they saw themselves all together, and conversations began to happen, and people noticed that what was keeping them so divided was this kind of government through which they were. It was sectarianism. It was a mode of government that has been in place since the 1990s. They began to demand something more. They demanded resignations, but they essentially demanded to set in place a different kind of government, a different mode of governance, a way in which we can really begin to build a true form of citizenship that can take the country, drive the country out of the financial crisis, the poverty, and give us an opportunity to live with dignity. This is really what it's about.
So, Mona Fawaz, dignity is very important. Fairness is very important. The desire for a non-corrupt state is very important. But one of the standout issues for your country is the sectarianism. And that has been the sort of de facto reality in the post-Civil War world. How does the future look if these very key offices have to be shared out amongst, you know, different faiths, the Sunni Muslims, the Shiite Muslims, the Druze?
Look, I mean, if you hear the songs down there, what they're actually saying is that finally we are liberated from these divisions. I'm not being delusional and imagining that sectarianism will disappear overnight. But what I'm noticing is that over the last few years, we're seeing one movement after the other, people increasingly taking stands against sectarianism, people increasingly feeling that the way in which they're categorized into sects and religious groups is basically undermining the possibility of building a nation. And this is what we've been hearing in the streets for the last two weeks. So, I mean, if you look at the teach-ins that we've been organizing, if you look at the debates that are happening on the streets, you hear a lot of people from all walks of life coming and then converging on this idea that, yes, we've been ingrained in so much corruption, and this corruption is really protected by a sectarian regime, and we want to imagine a different possibility. And it's becoming more and more the song of the street. So really, the hope is to see the response coming from the current leadership in the appointment of an independent government that's far from these sectarian divides and then can truly drive the country through the moment of financial crisis that we're living.
Mm-hmm. Mona, as you know, the group Hezbollah, which the whole world knows about because of its reactions with Israel, because of what it's been doing on behalf of Iran and Syrian President Bashar Assad in Syria, Hezbollah has been also talking about this. And actually, the leader, Hassan Nasrallah, has made some, you know, fairly unsubtle threats. Can we just play what he said recently about these demonstrations, and then I'll ask you about it.
In view of the difficult monetary, economic, and living situation, in view of the political tensions locally and in the region, in the shadow of what could be a target internationally and regionally, vacuum will lead to chaos. Vacuum will lead to collapse. I'm scared for the country. We are scared for the country. We are scared that there might be someone who wants to take Lebanon and create social, security, and political tensions that would lead to civil war.
Mona, he's raising the possibility of civil war again and lamenting a vacuum. Well, what do you say to that?
Look, I mean, I think that what we heard from the speeches of everyone who has some kind of leadership in the last week has been one of threatening with vacuum. But our constitutional mechanisms actually protect us from vacuum. There's a caretaker government. And if there's a true political will to set in place an independent government, the constitution completely allows for it. So there's no need for vacuum. I really want to go back and focus on how organic, decentralized, real the movement has been. It's been in all cities, it's been in every little town, spontaneous debate sessions coming up in public spaces, people rediscovering the possibility of collectives. And I think this is what scares actually everyone who has built its leadership over the country, over the idea that we're divided groups. I think it's a unique moment in our nation's history, and I really hope, I mean, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I really hope that this opportunity to set the country on the right place can happen, and there's a possibility to actually capitalize on it right now.
Okay. Mona Fawaz, thank you so much for joining us today. And Lebanon isn't the only country where protests will change the face of government. In Hong Kong today, the beleaguered chief executive Carrie Lam was forced to deny media reports that Beijing is preparing to replace her after 5 months of protests. And in Chile, President Sebastian Piñera replaced his cabinet on Monday after days of violent protest and a misguided military crackdown, where at least 20 people have been killed. It is as if much of Latin America is on the march. Peru, Bolivia, Argentina and Colombia have also seen huge crowds on the streets. Juan Manuel Santos is the former president of Colombia and a Nobel Peace laureate. I asked him whether democracy is failing when it comes to the fairness that people are demanding. President Santos, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you see what's happening in Lebanon, what's happening around the world, but what's happening on your continent? Latin America seems to be, you know, erupting in protests all over. The most severe are in Chile. There are even some in Colombia, but in Chile we've seen quite violent ones with up to 20 people who've been killed. First and foremost, what do you make of this? Why on your continent is this happening now?
And in Ecuador and in Haiti and all around.
Bolivia. And look, we've got a map which shows all of these various different locations.
I think this is a combination of different factors. First of all, democracy, freedom is one factor. Now people feel more empowered to protest. Second, inequality. That is, Latin America is the most unequal of all continents, and people are really feeling that. A third factor is progress. For example, in Chile, this is not a protest of the lower classes. It's the middle class that is going out. And what is happening all around Latin America is that we have been very successful in bringing a lot of people out of poverty, out of what the economists call the poverty trap. When you get somebody out of the poverty trap, their expectations increase geometrically.
But let's just dig down into that.
Because there's two other factors, inequality and corruption.
Okay.
Corruption is one of those words today that everybody is mad about, and people are also protesting.
So would you say that's the heart of it? Because analysts are trying to figure out whether there's a common thread to all these people power movements or people protest movements in the streets from Latin America all the way to Hong Kong in Asia, obviously. Do you think corruption is it?
I would say in certain areas, yes. Mm-hmm. But there is something that the economists call the demonstration effect. When people see that in Hong Kong, people can go and out to the street and be even violent, and a regime that is quite drastic, like the Chinese, allows that, then people feel, if you can do it in Hong Kong, we can do it here. So there is a combination of different factors.
So how do you feel then when it wasn't the Chinese tanks who came into Hong Kong, but it was President Piñera's tanks in Chile that came into Chile, and there are at least nearly a couple of dozen people dead? Is that an overreaction?
I think there was an overreaction. Chile needs, and many Latin American countries, need a more ample dialogue. People feel that they are not participating in the wealth that has been created and not participating in the basic and fundamental decisions. And we need to open up our democracies, and because the elections are not sufficient anymore. You need to make people feel that they are empowered in other aspects.
Chile, it's been out of military dictatorship for 3 decades. It is one of the richest countries in Latin America. Although, as you say, it has also the biggest inequality division there. And this was a hike which amounted to 30 pesos of a subway fare ticket. And the government quickly stepped back and rescinded that, but they're still on the streets. It is reported that the president himself, who's been in office for many years, is a billionaire. I don't know whether that's true, but that's what the... Is that true?
That is true.
Yeah.
He is one of the richest persons in Chile.
So is that appropriate?
Well,
I mean, doesn't that actually from the very top spell the problem? Or is that just inevitable, that anybody can run, and if it's the richest man in Chile, well, why not?
Well, I think that if he's very rich, why not? And if he's willing to make a service to his country, why not? But of course, this also, in a way, adds to the frustration and the anger of the people.
Are you a very rich man? Were you very rich when you were president?
No, but I was rich. I am part of the upper 2 or 3% of the population with no doubt whatsoever.
Do you think President Piñera should resign? He's already reshuffled his cabinet. As I said, he stepped back from the subway fare hike, and yet the protests are still going on.
No,
we've seen what just happened in Lebanon.
Yes,
the Prime Minister
but
resigned.
I don't think he should resign.
Why?
I think he should hear that what people are saying, and he should sort of make a more profound change. What he has done so far is not enough. I think people are saying we need more. President Lagos was talking about a constitutional assembly to change the constitution. There is a frustration in Chile since the transition to democracy because it was controlled by Pinochet. And so
that's the military dictator.
The military dictator that Chile had for some so long.
Decades, yeah. Let me just read you a few stats. As I said, and as you said, massive inequality, despite it reduced the number of people living in poverty, you know, it dropped to 6.4% in 2017 from 30% in 2000, according to the World Bank. But half of Chilean workers earn $550 a month or less. It is one of the most unequal of the world's richest nations, according to the OECD. And this is what one of the protesters has said.
This is the discontent of the people in reality. They are years of repression. They are years of living in misery. They are years of government-imposed measures at the expense of the people. And when one goes out to the streets to demand their rights, to demand dignified life, they put us in repressive forces.
She is reflecting this frustration, inequality that she says she sees in her country and what we see in all of Latin America. But she is neglecting the fact that millions of people have gone out of poverty, which is normal in the political life. You don't see the history, you see the future.
So what happens when people start to feel that democracy, and in this case, absolute free market? I mean, Chile is one of the most devoted countries in Latin America to the free market, and that's what's made people very upset as well, that, you know, their education and their health and all of that is very, very expensive for a lot of people who are used to it being much more accessible. You've seen what's happened just recently in Argentina. The elections brought back the populists, the Peronists. You've seen, as you mentioned, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Venezuela, slightly different, but also in Brazil, where populists are coming to power. What does that say about democracy in your continent especially, which was so heavy in the military junta and the military dictatorships?
Well, it's happening all around the world. The combination of democracy and a very unjust capitalism. People are seeing that the market is not functioning for them. And so what we also need to rethink is our economic model. How can we make our democracy and our economic development more inclusive, that people feel they are part of the progress? What is happening is that the middle classes are not feeling that they are being benefited by the progress of the country. And also something that has, in a way, exacerbated the frustration, is that the economy, the cycle of the economy, has gone down in Chile and in every country in Latin America. Colombia today is the country that is going to grow the highest this year, and we're not going to grow more than 3%. So there is also an economic effect on what is happening.
Do you think you got the economic effect right when you were president?
I think I did. The figures are there. We were one of the countries that grew the most, but we grew.
But was it just? Was it just capitalism?
By bringing in the people from poverty to the middle class, mm-hmm. and by reducing inequality. We were the country that reduced inequality more in the last 8 years than any other country in Latin America. And that is very, very important.
Now, one of the issues that you had to deal with, and you dealt with it for many years, was a very long and detailed process of trying to end the continent's longest war, which was between your government and FARC, the Marxist rebels. It's sort of, I don't know, is it hanging in the balance, the peace process right now? The elections this weekend for local government, the first since the peace deal. How do you assess what happened?
Well, I think the results of the elections of last Sunday are a very clear signal that the country wants the peace deal to continue, wants the government to be more aggressive in implementing what had been agreed, and the peace process is going in the correct way, even though it has problems, like any peace process. Making peace is much more difficult than making war. And the peace process, after 50 years of war, was a very difficult peace process. And we're in that phase of reconciliation, of constructing the peace. And you don't construct peace after 50 years of war from one day to another. You have to do it in long term and persevering.
So if you had a prescription for the president of Chile or of the other countries that we've spoken about, the ones where protests are happening, how would you advise them to do what you did, which was reduce inequality in Colombia?
Well, what we did was a very sort of focused policies to the people we wanted to help. I even imported a formula from a professor in Oxford, Professor Amartya Sen.
He won Nobel Prize winner.
Something called a multidimensional index to fight poverty and to have a more just economic model. And it worked. It worked very well. You can do it.
Is it still being implemented in Colombia?
It's still being implemented and with good success.
And you said you can do it. So why aren't the others doing it?
Well, sometimes they don't have the backing from the Congress. They cannot approve the laws in Congress. For example, Piñera has a problem with his Congress.
He doesn't
have an overall majority. Many countries have that type of problems. I didn't have it because I created a coalition which allowed me to implement very drastic and audacious reforms.
So can I ask you, because this is also a feature of what's happening, it's very polarized societies, it's very sectarian societies. Are you kind of saying that in order to create an economy or a just capitalism, you actually can't do it just from one end of the spectrum? You actually need to have coalitions and the whole group on board?
Yes. Polarization is the worst enemy of good government. Because what it does is it sort of it stops a government from being audacious and taking even unpopular decisions. I had to deal with very unpopular decisions that are unpopular in the short run but necessary in the long run. If you don't have a big majority, you cannot do that.
So the only way to do it is to get everybody else on board?
Well, or a big majority, yes. And create a consensus that everybody, in a way, feels that they're part of the deal.
Fascinating. President Santos, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Christiana.
Remember that word, consensus? Now, from a Nobel winner to an Emmy winner, the actor John Lithgow has racked up all kinds of awards, Emmys, Tonys, and Golden Globes. You may know him from Third Rock, From the Sun, or Dexter. And soon you'll see him portraying the man who reshaped American media and politics before his long history of alleged sexual harassment caught up with him. Fox News chairman Roger Ailes. Lithgow plays him in the new film Bombshell, which has raised some early Oscar buzz. He's also turned his talents to writing and is out with a satirical poetry collection, Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse, which chronicles the last few raucous years in American politics. Why this departure? He tells our Hari Srinivasan.
Let's start with the book. It's called Dumpty. Why write it?
Well, it was quite a surprise to me. It was a bright idea that it actually grew out of a performance I gave at a New York Public Theater gala in Central Park a few years ago. They asked me to sing the Major General's song from Pirates of Penzance as an entertainment. And I said, sure, but I'll perform it in the character of Michael T. Flynn, and I'll rewrite the final verse. I've dressed up makeup and hair and wig of Michael T. Flynn and launched into the third verse, took the audience completely by surprise. When President Obama made me head of all things clandestine, he realized he'd brought to life a governmental Frankenstein, etc. And it killed. The audience was so surprised. And they found it so hilarious. And I shared that with my literary agent, not with a view to a book idea. He's the one who said, there's your book.
Mm.
And he said, I could sell this tomorrow. So I said, he said, to half the country.
What about the other half?
Half the country. Well, good Lord, that's a lot more than what, that's a bigger percentage than most books of any kind.
Let me start by having you read just the first one that kind of sets the tone for the whole book.
Right. This sort of explains the title. It's as if it needed explaining. It's called Trumpty Dumpty. Trumpty Dumpty wanted a wall to stir up a rabid political brawl. His Republican rivals, both feckless and stodgy, succumbed in the end to his rank demagogy. Dumpty's wall made no earthly sense, a boondoggle built at enormous expense, but he promised in speeches despotic and shrill he'd make certain that Mexico footed the bill. Trumpty Dumpty kept insisting. More and more citizens started resisting. Sadly, there won't be an end to this tale, at least until reasonable people prevail. That's a poem that more or less declares my bias. Seen as a sort of introductory poem.
Now, how did you write these? Because some of these, or actually most of these, are responding to events as really they unfold.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of, it's roughly chronological between June of 2018 and April 1st, 2019, when my deadline hit and I had to have all of them completed. That means that an awful lot has happened since then. Things move so quickly in this day and age. It feels like a century ago.
Yeah.
It immediately turned it into a piece of history instead of a piece of political, contemporary political commentary.
You know, people are going to watch this and say, oh, Hollywood liberals, what can you expect? Of course, this is what the guy from Footloose has turned.
Uh-huh. Well, I haven't turned. I'm an old, my parents were old FDR lefties, and I grew up, as many of us, most of us do, with my politics as a kind of birthright. But I've just kept them to myself. I don't think I'm surprising that many people. They probably know I'm a liberal.
You can understand, or can you understand, how the president has appealed to half the country?
Yeah, it's true. There is just different kinds of entertainment. I've been in a lot of things. When I was on Third Rock from the Sun, it was
Mr.
sort of
Potato
the,
Man is
at
all the company
that
I
moment.
Need.
I was doing sitcom on NBC, and along came Survivor. It was the beginning of the reality TV era. In no time at all, more people were watching reality television than scripted television. And to me, it was like people are watching lousy television instead of expert television. You know, the expert entertainers are losing their audience to just the sort of chaos of reality TV. You know, it's just a reality you live with as an entertainer. I just have my standards and my taste.
Yeah.
They're completely different from the standards and taste of a lot of people. That goes for politics, too, obviously.
There was a recent stage performance where you got to read the words of President Trump in the Mueller report.
I greatly appreciate you informing me that I am not under investigation.
It was abridged. It was beautifully edited into an hour and a 10-minute piece of theater, really, by Edward Schenken, the Pulitzer and Tony-winning playwright. It was we ran it through once and then performed it live, streaming online. about 15 actors, really good actors, whoever was available in, here in New York. So there was Kevin Kline, Annette Bening, Michael Shannon, Jason Alexander. It was astonishing how much of the report was written in dialogue. So we were actually speaking the words of these people.
Yeah.
And there was no tweaking reality. We were simply performing it.
Speaking of performing, you just recently did Mayor Giuliani.
Yes.
So you've spoken the words of the president and yes. Also parodied.
Well, spoken the words of fantastic comedy writers on the staff of The Late Show.
Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us. I haven't asked you anything yet.
I know. And your facts are all wrong. So shush it, zip it.
And it was hilarious. We rehearsed for all of 3 minutes and just let it rip.
What would Rudy say right now in this interview? How do you change your face or change your mannerisms or your voice? How do you do that?
Well, as always, you have wonderful co-conspirators.
Yeah.
Your confederates. They did a great half-hour makeup. I brought my own teeth. They were actually my own teeth from Buckaroo Banzai from 30 years ago.
Still fit.
I looked everywhere for them, and I found them. They still fit. And they just simply painted them bright white with water-based shellac that washed right off.
So once you get into costume, do you feel like you are
character? I was more like him than ever. And I was able to look right into the camera because that's where the teleprompter was.
Yeah.
So it looked like I was concentrating deeply. I was only reading the words as they rolled by. Stephen was over here asking me questions, and I just let it rip. I did this mad parody of him.
You've got a movie coming out where you're playing Roger Ailes. First, let's take a look at a clip from that movie, a little part of the trailer.
Mm-hmm. I want to convince you that I belong on air, Mr. Ailes. I think I'd be freaking phenomenal on your network.
I could pluck you out and move you to the front of the line, but I need to know that you're loyal. I need you to find a way to prove it.
I'm the bad guy.
You know why Roger's got that door blocking his office.
Someone has to speak up. Someone has to get mad.
Oh, fantastic actors. Charlize Theron, Nicole Kidman, Margot Robbie. What's the key there? I mean, you're under, obviously, makeup and so forth, but what's the key to mimicking someone? How do you get their mannerisms? How do you study for it?
Well, I found all that I could. Video of Roger, which was not easy because he himself didn't like to be seen that much. He liked his people to be seen. I was enormously helped by just all the physical things, the fat suit and the makeup, and this marvelous script by Charles Randolph. But you just, it's an imaginative leap. Just use my body and my voice. It's all I have to work with, and just did my best to inhabit this man and make people briefly forget about what he was really like and just accept my version of it. That's, if there's a trick, that's as close as I can come to describing it.
I mean, you know, you've had this ability to hit people in different generations. There's going to be a group of people who listen to this or watch this and say, is that the guy whose voice is in Shrek?
Mm-hmm. Right?
And then there's going to be people who grew up watching Third Rock from the Sun. And then there's going to be someone that has that sort of Footloose reference or the Twilight Zone movie.
Uh-huh.
And these are all different moments. And then, of course, there's people who might remember you from the stage in Broadway when you were coming up. It's kind of rare to find people actually able to stay relevant in these different forms for a good chunk of their career. I mean, this is a hard business to stay on top of.
It is. I mean, it's the source of a lot of pride, the fact that I'm still around, still viable, more hireable than ever. It turns out I've finally grown into my role as a fat old man.
So you've been training your whole life for this, really.
You know, I grew up in a theater family.
Yeah.
And a unique theater family. My father created and produced Shakespeare festivals in the Midwest. mean, talk about appealing to different camps sure. through entertainment. We lived in about 8 different places. We traveled around like a gypsy wagon. Mm. I worked for my dad. I acted in 20 Shakespeare plays by the time I was 20 years old, mostly in small roles.
So now, did you want to do that? Or
I loved it. I didn't intend to be an actor. I was much more interested in being an artist, actually. But I went away to college and fell in with the theater gang, and I was a seasoned actor already. And
right.
And it was what I was destined to do, no matter, in spite of myself. But it was Shakespeare. Shakespeare was at the heart of what my father did. Mm. I knew Shakespeare much better than I knew Arthur Miller, Eugene O'Neill, Tennessee Williams. They were a mystery to me.
Yeah.
Even naturalistic acting was something, I was used to yelling to the back row of an outdoor theater with no amplification. Shakespeare wrote for all different occasions and for many different audiences. The man who wrote Hamlet wrote Comedy of Errors. The man who wrote Macbeth wrote The Merry Wives of Windsor. And then he mixed history plays with romantic comedies, As You Like It. That's how I sort of backed into this curious career, I think, is acting in many different forms.
Yeah.
And I like making people laugh every bit as much as I like making them cry or scream out in terror. It's just, Shakespeare wrote Gothic horror, too.
Mm.
I did Pet Sematary last year. He wrote Titus Andronicus.
So you're really drawing back on the stuff that you learned really as a teenager.
By osmosis.
Yeah.
Never gave it that much thought.
Yeah.
But I played, they were repertory, the plays that played in repertory. 5, 6, 7 plays in a summer season. So you were playing a very different kind of play every night of the week. And in a sense, that's without ever calculating it, that's what I've done. Jumping from movies and TV and stage, for one thing.
Yeah. So which are you doing to feed what? Do you do films to say, between Broadway or?
Well, the taproot for me is the theater, and I return to theater fairly regularly and often. There was a 14-year period when I was in L.A., when I did Third Rock from the Sun,
yeah.
a lot of movie work, when I was not in New York theater at all. But then I came back and did M. Butterfly, which is one of the great stage experiences.
With B.D. Wong, both of you were had amazing performances for that. What's it like to take on a role like, Winston Churchill? I mean, everybody's read about him. There's plenty of people who've played him in the past, and here you are. How do you redefine this? How do you do this justice?
Yeah.
Well,
it's a curious thing. It's a big English production, and there's one thing that's very distinctive about the English theater tradition. No one is selfish about a role. When I went over to play Malvolio with the Royal Shakespeare Company, there were 3 other Malvolios going on: Patrick Stewart, Stephen Fry, and Derek Jacobi.
Wow.
That makes 4 in all in one season. Now, in America, you would sulk about that, but not in England. They all run to see each other's performance, to see what they can use in theirs, you know. When I did King Lear, there were like 4 King Lears in town. And when I did Churchill, there were, Brian Cox was playing Churchill. Gary Oldman won the Oscar for Churchill. And there was another, the great Michael Gambon. You know, you're just philosophical. You think, well, I hope that mine is different. I had the advantage of being in an extraordinary piece of material. Peter Morgan's marvelous writing, acting with Claire Foy and Eileen Atkins and Harriet Walter and Stephen DeLane, all these great, great actors. There was also a wonderful point of view to the crown. It was about the crown, and mainly it was about the queen. And it was about monarchy and the whole role of monarchy in government, which is a large and unfathomable subject. Winston Churchill was a supporting player. I think that's a great advantage particularly when you're playing a famous person. I think the other actors sort of who played Churchill, they carried the burden of being the story.
Yeah.
Same with Roger Ailes. Roger Ailes fits in just right into Bombshell. That is a movie about the women of Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about not just the three big stars, but about a dozen women and how all of them reacted and responded differently to a crisis at Fox. And I was the crisis.
So do you ever get intimidated now? I mean, now that you've played such a wide range of roles and all kinds of mediums, I mean, when you read a script or when you read a project, what is it that you look for? What is it that you say, I don't know?
You look for good writing. It all, so much springs from good writing. And I've done some pieces that were just mediocre writing, if not bad. You do them for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are people you want to work with, or because you're going to be paid a lot more money, or because it's time to do a big studio movie. I've always said the only difficult acting is bad writing. You just somehow make it work for yourself.
So would you call yourself at the end of, as the movie reel of your life kind of flashes before your eyes, what do you think? I said, okay, I'm an artist, I'm a entertainer, I'm a painter, I'm a drawer.
Well, at all those things, I'm a very good actor.
Yeah, yeah, there's that.
Yeah, I am a dabbler for sure. I'm a dabbler as a poet. I don't call myself a poet. I have too much respect for genuine poets who write with their own blood, you know.
You're a rhymer.
I'm a clown, really. I'm a smart-ass clown.
John Lithgow, thanks so much.
Really, such a pleasure, Hari.
A jack of all theatrical trades then, John Lithgow. And join us tomorrow for my conversation with movie star Antonio Banderas. I will ask him about his recent health scare, a heart attack, and how that helped him get in touch with his own vulnerabilities for his latest film, Pain and Glory, directed by the great Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar. But that is it for now. Remember, you can listen to our podcast, see us online at amanpour.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.